When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Show me the one whose safety deemed such destruction. You must reunite it with its own kind.
Where?
This you must determine. The songs of eons past tell of battles between Mandalore the Great and an order of sorcerers called Jedi.
You expect me to search the galaxy and deliver this creature to a race of enemy sorcerers?
This is the way.
You know this is no place for a child.
Wherever I go, he goes.
So I've heard.
This is the way.
Season 2 of Disney Plus series The Mandalorian recently earned a remarkable 24 Emmy nominations, including for its cinematography, production design, and visual effects. In this episode, we're joined by visual effects supervisor Richard Bluff and production designers Andrew L. Jones and Doug Chang. Bluff and Jones won Emmys a year ago for their work on the series, and visual effects and production design veteran Doug Chang is a 1993 Oscar winner for the visual effects in Death Becomes Her. In this episode, they join us to discuss the making of The Mandalorian Season 2 using their latest advanced virtual production techniques. I also asked them about the de-aged Mark Hamill that appeared in the season finale, but they declined to discuss this work. This episode focuses primarily on the episode titled The Jedi, which is set on the planet Corvus and earned the production design nomination. I'm Carolyn Giardina. Welcome to The Hollywood Reporter's Behind the Screen. So welcome, congratulations on the season and your Emmy nominations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
So the making of the series relied heavily on virtual production techniques, which is still a relatively new concept for many people. So for the uninitiated, Richard, would you begin by describing the process and why filmmakers are turning to these tools?
Well, it's interesting. I think a lot of the tools that we use started out life actually a long time ago. You can kind of trace a lot of what we do back to AI. Shows like Avatar and Jungle Book that Jon Favreau obviously worked on and Lion King. So I think what's different about our show is the amount of the tools that we pull together, but also the fact that it all ends up largely on our wraparound LED screens. I think the important part of why we use it is I think that Jon likes to get everybody immersed in virtual reality to experience what the sets and the environments are going to be before we ever photograph them, and to understand if, from a design perspective, if they're large enough, if they're small enough, and if they you know invoke the right sort of a response from the actors and obviously from the creatives themselves.
And to give everyone an idea, so when you're shooting on this stage, the actors are performing in front of this LED screen. How large is it roughly?
So the volume that we've got is 90 feet long, 75 feet wide, and roughly egg-shaped, and then it's 23 feet tall. There's a LED ceiling panel covering the entire ceiling, And we have a couple of doors that come in that allow us to get sets in and out and complete the 360 environment, the immersion.
So in the episode, the Jedi, the Mandalorian and Grogu visit the forest planet of Corvus. So before we talk about how it's applied in virtual production, let's talk about the design of the planet itself. I'm sure the research started with the material itself, but would you talk about any research that you did and how you conceived the look?
Yeah, that started very early on with Dave, because he was very keen on sort of creating a very desolate landscape. And now specifically story-driven, so we always start with sort of the story and character intent. From there, I mean, you know, unfortunately, we had, you know, fires in the Northern California, and some of them were very close to Dave's home. And so that kind of drew the inspiration in terms of this desolate landscape, because he really wanted to create an environment that has been devastated by our main character that's here. So we referenced a lot of that, did obviously a lot of research into what devastated landscape can look like. And we also lean into quite a bit of Kurosawa's films as well, because, you know, in this one, the tone of it for Dave, he was trying to match some of that to sort of draw from the original inspiration that inspired George Lucas. And so we really heavily researched into that, and then we kind of adapted it to make it our own. And so, for instance, the castle itself, you can see, is very reminiscent of Japanese feudal castles. And we did that specifically to invoke those feelings. And then the landscape, you know, literally was, you know, taken off of, you know, photography that we did of the burnt forests around Northern California. And it was really then a matter of them merging the two aesthetics to create this very exotic environment that would help support the character.
We did actually go out to the burnt fields, the burnt forests around Los Angeles to get samples and bring them back and scan them and ended up using some of that. Terrible situation, but it inspired the design quite heavily, as did the sort of hazy atmosphere.
And then would you tell us about how you actually created this environment that would be then projected onto the LED wall?
So we're using game engines to build virtual environments, which are used for design development, based on Doug's concept art that the team do up in San Francisco. And we have a team in Los Angeles who are creating these virtual environments using scans of real-world objects like trees and rocks and ground conditions, and lit by our DP, Baz Eidewein. And then we go in and scout these with a camera and see if they're working as virtual environments. Once you've got the whole environment created, the sky psych, the forest environment, for example, the ground condition, and you stage a scene in it, you kind of know what you're going to need to build inside the volume as a physical set, and you get more or less, it's like a cookie cutter. You stamp out of the virtual environment the part that's going to be a physical build, and then that goes to the traditional crafts who are going to make that physically based on renders from the game engine.
Richard, do you want to jump in here and talk about the work of ILM?
Yeah, so I think when the work has been approved, that's been developed by Doug and Andrew Jones's production design team and the art department, it ultimately gets turned over to ILM that then continue to advance those environments. In this particular instance, we took it from Unreal into ILM Stagecraft toolset. Built out the environments even further. They also kind of gathered scans, 3D scans and photography from various different landscapes to help develop the environment. And I think what's also important to remember is that when we're scouting these environments in virtual reality, you're basically with a headset on, it's 2K and it's 60 frames per second for performance reasons. But of course, when we hit the wall, it's got to be at least 24 frames per second and largely a 50K image all the way around, depending on where you point the camera. So an awful lot of work is done in order to make sure that the scale stands up on the screen, even though it's not always obvious looking at the before and after what's being done. Basically, it's all getting supersized to go on the screen, so it basically stands up at any resolution with any lens we have in our kit. And of course, making sure that when the physical sets come together with the LED wall in the background, that we have just as much control in the CG environment that we would have on set. So if Baz and special effects want to increase the atmosphere and the smoke in the physical set. We want to be able to dial the smoke in and out on the actual 3D content on the wall to make sure that there's a nice blend. So all of that controllability needs to be built in and be on sliders on an iPad. So on the day, it's as quick and as efficient as possible. So production can move as efficiently as they need to while shooting in these spaces.
And you used a new version of Stagecraft in this season. Would you describe the advances and what you were able to do in season two that maybe you weren't able to do during the first season?
You know, there was an awful lot that changed from season one to season two. And I think almost all of it came from filmmaker requests, whether it was John or Dave, obviously, you know, Andrew, but also the DPs and, you know, the gaffer as well. So the first thing that was different for season two was the scale of the size of the volume was bigger, but then also the pixel resolution on the screen was supersized. It was a great deal larger than season one, so we could have much sharper images on screen. Beyond that, we were shooting with two camera frustums, so two camera field of views, where we had control over which field of view overlapped the other if the camera point of views crossed. We had the ability to color correct the ceiling relative to the camera point of view as well, so we could increase the number of in-camera finals we would have, because obviously the glancing angle of the ceiling is a different math problem to solve when color correcting that versus a vertical wall. But aside from that, there was many, many more improvements. We were able to individually select any rock, any pebble on the ground, or any tree in this particular environment and effectively move them around, rather than selecting a section of a landscape and collecting everything as a baked mesh. And again, it was all to service the filmmakers through the experiences we had on season one. That was really the goal, to make the shooting as efficient as possible and as flexible as possible.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
In addition to the forest, Doug and Andrew, do you want to elaborate on the design for the interior of the city?
Oh, yes. No, absolutely. I mean, one of the fun things about it is we're always trying to push the technology as far as possible, you know, being guided by the story aesthetics. And one of the challenges that we had was that the castle itself, or this fortress, was designed to have an outer part, a village part, and then an inner keep. And there was a really wonderful opportunity to distinguish the two aesthetically, because Dave Filoni was insistent that the outer part really reflected sort of the poor living conditions of the villagers. And then the inner keep was going to be like this inner sanctum, which is almost like a paradise, you know, more of a garden feel. And one of the things that we really wanted to try was make it very much like a pristine Japanese garden. We brought in water features. And this was something that, you know, Andrew and I were really keen on exploring, you know, how effective can we actually do this in the volume. And in the end, you know, once we had the design of the set, it was a terrific matchup, because the water gave you a real naturalistic reflection. And so a lot of those shots were done in camera that expanded the scope of what could have been built, but we really didn't build as much as, you know, what you see on the screen. And it turned out to be a terrific merging of the two, you know, aesthetically and technologically, for, you know, to achieve sort of, you know, Dave's vision on this.
And part of the benefit of the LED process for our show is that our lead character is wearing very reflective silver armor. So being able to reflect a 360-degree scenic environment is really important. You know, you're not getting blue screen spill. You're basically just getting it in camera. So the step to try using water and the reflection in water was something we tried on this episode. Not sure how it was going to work, but it ended up working very well. And the experience of that has kind of emboldened us to try more reflective surfaces and use water and chrome and all of the things that you would probably have difficulty on a blue screen stage doing.
Mm-hmm. And Richard, on the character front, you obviously used more traditional puppet techniques with Grogu, but you also had CG characters throughout the season. Would you like to talk about those?
Yeah, and just going back to the magistrate's
courtyard a little bit. You know, in the background we had one of the droids there, and obviously on the day we had a performer in a half a costume, and obviously green spandex for the areas that would be replaced with a CG droid. And you know, one of the nice things I think about you know, the experience that Doug has working in the Star Wars universe and how collaborative the show feels across all departments, of course, is that we all kind of get to have a voice in how these visual effects are going to be achieved, but also, of course, you know, what we would like to try and achieve practically on the day, because that's really important for our show. You know, we really do like to try to recapture the charm of the original movies, because I think that you know, when you look at Grogu itself, the character, the reason I think why the character is so successful is because it is a puppet. And I think it's not something that is fully synthetic. People believe it's actually in the scene. He's been picked up by all the different characters. And so for us in visual effects, when we do need to do a full CG version of Grogu, we're always leveraging what's gone before us. We're always leveraging what we've seen the puppeteers do to try and perform the baby. And that goes into the facial performance. We actually took the baby puppet and along with the puppeteers, and we actually did a full 3D scan of the puppeteers performing the facial motion and the movement of the baby in CG. So we effectively had a 3D representation of how the baby moved through all its range of motion. And then that was kind of baked into the animator's sliders when they're actually on the computer driving the animated version. So they can't actually make the baby, the CG baby, perform beyond the limitations of the actual puppet. And again, it's these are the lengths that we like to go to try and make sure that we are maintaining the charm of kind of what's gone before.
In addition to that character, maybe we could describe another one that maybe is fully CG, like the dragon.
Oh, the Crate Dragon.
Probably worth talking about the design, right, Doug?
Yeah. Now, the Crate Dragon was really, it was an interesting challenge because what's wonderful about The Mandalorian and John and Dave's approach is that we like to take obscure moments from the original trilogy and then really expand on them. Because if you think about it, our characters are really secondary characters. And so we had hints of what a Crate Dragon was in the bones that we saw in A New Hope. And it was very different. It was literally like a Apatosaurus skeleton. And the thinking there was, you know, there's been some design development in terms of what that creature is. And it was always very small. And for John's storytelling, he wanted this creature to be big and to be huge as a menace, as a threat to the town of Mos Pelgo. And so we did a lot of research in terms of extrapolating, okay, what can it be? So we don't break what's been established before. And part of the logic was that the version that we saw in A New Hope was a baby. And so as it grows and as it matures, it actually grows quite big and it evolves quite a lot. And because our version was actually going to be underneath the sand, we had to come up with a logic of how does it maneuver underneath the sand? And the thinking was that it was going to be like a shark underneath the sand. And that drove the aesthetics where we started to evolve the head to give it a very shark-like silhouette. And this was very specific because we wanted to, you know, for this whole sequence, play it up like Jaws, like the shark in Jaws, where you saw peekaboo bits of it, and that kind of enhanced the drama of it. And so going with the motif of a shark-like nose, but then expanding on a scale to know that it could actually literally swim underneath the sand. Part of the other logic was, well, then how does it maneuver underneath the sand? And so we gave it legs. And some of the development art for early Crate Dragons that have been done, you know, quite a bit in the wildlife books of Star Wars showed legs. But we wanted ours to be even more. And again, part of the thinking was that this creature, as it matures, and we've never seen a fully mature version until now, is that the legs grow as the body grows. And so that gave us a perfect, you know, locomotion for this creature. And early on, we had done some previous development where that was going to be the sort of how we reveal this creature, is that you see literally all these legs underneath the sand. Ultimately, it became much more simplistic, but that really drove the design aesthetics. And so we did all the homework in terms of designing what a Crate Dragon should be and merged it perfectly, you know, or as best as we could with the story that John wanted to tell.
Yeah, I think the challenge from a visual effects standpoint, and I think at this point I should point out that my colleague Joe Bauer was the lead visual effects supervisor on that sequence, and obviously ILM was the lead visual effects house. The challenge that ILM had
was that we did indeed have this fully developed creature underneath the sand. And even though in the majority of the shots, you just kind of saw the neck and the head, you had the full body, you had the full tail, and you had many, 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 many individual legs. But in many ways, it was incredibly helpful to have all of that design exploration from Doug and his team, and obviously the writing and the very clear vision from John as to what he wanted to see, because it meant as though we didn't really have to cheat anything. What we had to do is to explore, once we had an animation cycle of this creature underneath the sand, how it was going to actually move the sand around. Because obviously what we're talking about is very complex fluid dynamics. And in water, it makes a lot more sense. But of course, with sand, you're going to struggle with scale. And of course, in order to kind of have the sand move around to allow the creature to kind of move through, the sand's going to move a great deal. And as soon as you start seeing that, then all of a sudden the scale feels really small. So it was always this back and forth challenge that the individual artists, the simulators had to make sure that not only the sand movement felt realistic, but also as well, it had the scale and it had the scope and it wasn't betraying the designs and obviously the creative that John had. So in order to emphasize that, whenever it breached, of course, we needed to make sure there was multiple layers of different types of sand and different particulate size kind of falling off, whether it was dust that kind of gave you the impression that it was this huge thing, to sand streaming off, almost it was like water. So very, very complex creature that was equally challenging for all the simulators and of course all the composers after the fact to make sure that the scale really, really read. One thing that I think we kind of have to bring up, of course, is the terrible pandemic we've all been through and that we all continue to go through. And I think that we were very fortunate that we wrapped principal photography about a week before the shelter in place orders kind of came out. But from a visual effects standpoint, we had 14 vendors worldwide, and almost every single one of them all started moving to working from home in a very short space of time, and I think it goes without saying that we're incredibly grateful for all the work they were able to do, during this difficult time, because we continued to meet our deadlines and the show came out on time. But also on top of that, we in particular some of the challenges that ILM were faced in episode 7, we were intending to go to location to Hawaii to photograph background plates, establishing plates, and texture reference for the episode where we visit the jungle planet, particularly for the sequence with the juggernaut that was over 250 visual effects shots. And very quickly, we had to do an about turn and turn that entire sequence into a fully synthetic jungle environment. And I think that was one of the biggest challenges we had in post-production, because it was something we weren't able to plan for. But I think through the wonderful work that the ILM did and led by Enrico Dam, and obviously the library of jungle reference that the ILM has, they really turned what was going to be something that we were going to photograph into something CG that you really can't tell as far as I'm concerned. I'm really proud of the work that the teams did trying to turn that around and really kind of achieve the vision that Doug and Andrew kind of came up with in initial designs.
And to give everyone a sense of this, could you give us an estimate of how many, quote, visual effect shots were in the season?
We were just shy of 4,000 visual effect shots.
And I might add, I mean, one of the terrific experiences of working with Jon Favreau on this whole thing is that, we're really trying to blur sort of all the department heads. And that's partly driven by the schedule, because we have such a short production schedule in terms of, you know, the production design of it all. And this is where it's great, you know, working with Richard and his team, we really try to bring all that work up front, you know, work that would typically be post-production work. We're bringing it up front because we need that content for the volume. And it really demands that everybody stay very focused in terms of how we collaborate. And what's really wonderful is that, you know, between Richard, myself, and Andrew, we work very collaboratively. And so once we get a design approved, once we take it into virtual space, we start to implement and engage the ILM team to create final assets. And the only way we can do that is really, you know, allowing us to do virtual scouts very early on. So the minute John approves a set, we usually have a very preliminary CG model that we can literally start to, you know, scout in VR to see if the scale's right. And we get answers, you know, days into the process versus months. And it's a one way, you know, of really shortcutting, you know, the whole, you know, design challenge process in there, because we can just be moved more effectively. And we usually, during those virtual scouts, we bring in all the department heads. So everybody can kind of come in and have a voice, you know, like the DP can come in and say, you know, the way, you know, Andrew and I have designed a set, for instance, maybe one of the window mullions is in the way of a shot. Can we actually move it now versus discovering that after the fact? Or even things like scale, you know, how far should the space be? Because we're always trying to be very conscious of our production schedule, where we're trying to get the maximum impact for the least amount of builds. And sometimes we can still capture the original intent of the design, but minimizing the build without compromising the look. And it's something that, you know, Andrew and I, you know, work very closely with John and the other filmmakers to really go in and dissect, you know, what is the most effective way of doing all this.
Yeah, I'd like to add to that just real quick. It's interesting because I've been asked on a number of occasions about the artwork at the end of the credits. And people have assumed in conversations that the artwork is done after the fact, after the show is finished, and we know what the show now looks like, which is not the case at all. All the artwork at the end of the credits that Doug Chang oversees with his team and Andrew Jones, it's done in pre-production. So you can see that the show looks exactly how it was initially designed. And I think that's testament to what Doug's saying. It's rare that you're involved in a show on this size where you don't do several course corrections as you get into post-production. But again, because a lot of visual effects work is pulled up at the beginning, but also because a lot of the artists that Doug uses have perhaps worked on them for many years, and maybe they were once modelers. There's such an interchange of those assets and those models and the way we work that all of those ideas really do exist and last right through the end of production. But it's also really a kind of testament to John and to Dave Filoni and the rest of the filmmakers in that we aren't changing our minds. Generally, if there's something that changes, it's because it's out of necessity with the story. But largely, the design lives right from the very beginning all the way through post-production, which is rare. And I think allows us to kind of do the sort of volume of visual effects shots we're talking about in such a short space of time.
And that's what makes everything sort of very fluid in that sense, because designs go back and forth, you know, all the way through, you know, shooting, all the way through to post-production. And it's, you know, it's a wonderful way because, you know, obviously as the story comes together, as we get our first assembly of the cut, the story ideas may change, sets may change a little bit. And this gives us the freedom to actually massage those. And John is always insistent that, you know, sometimes if the set that was approved, you know, months ago prior to shooting, now he's seen it in the editorial, he wants to evolve a little bit. You know, that's why we stay involved throughout the whole process, you know, doing paint overs, redesigns as necessary. And it's a really great back and forth. So really, there is no post-production or pre-production. It's all one big process now.
Thank you all so much for joining us and congratulations on the season.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.